anyways, the other, there was a, some other, there were some other people who were supposed to be coming, but they couldn't, so I'm here. Normally, this course I'm going to try and squeeze into two nights. So we normally, the Vancouver People's Law School normally covers in about four nights. So if we miss a great big part of it and you are interested, then by all means attend one of those other courses, you know, or one of the law school's courses on women law, or for that matter, in another month or so, our film on women in the law will be done, and it's a four-hour thing, and you can just sit in your room and look at it on the TV, or you can stand it for 4 hours. If you have questions, there's a mic there that I guess was set up for when there was going to be a million people, so that just makes it easier. One mic amongst a million is very few and all that, but adequate. And so just shout out if you have a question or you disagree or you've heard of some new ruling or something like that. Okay. To begin, the problem for women with law in the English system of law arose about the time that it stopped being just a handful of aristocracy who could pass on their property, and so I don't know, about 1300 and something, 1200 and something, a new law was passed where men could give their property to their sons. So it naturally became slightly more important to determine who their sons were in a rigorous way, and that is always the problem for men, is to discover if for sure. The other thing is the great trick, and the only real out women have, is the just bloody uncertainty of it from a man's point of view. I was having a talk with my old man about this the other day, and I said, well, you know, the thing is that I always know who my children are, and that's a big advantage, you know. You, on the other hand, so, which was very pertinent discussion at the time, as I am more or less huffing and puffing about in the world with this growing incapacity. And so, anyway, at that point, marriages, which had up to then been very informally arranged, people were living together and they made some slight announcement to the community, etc., began to be arranged in an increasingly formal way. And so some of the older problems of women became more acute, i.e. it became important if you wanted protection for your own children and your own self to be certain that you were married or have gone through the formalities of whatever sort to the man before you started living with him. And so what most feminist writers identify as a sort of two-class system amongst women, which is largely determined by men, began to be a fairly severe problem for women in the English law area. This is incidentally English law, all the law that went out in all the colonies that eventually became countries, etc., came out of there. And so that's what I mean by English law areas. In other words, you had increasing pressure, and you have an enormous amount of pressure on women to conform in a number of ways in order to be under the protection of the law. And for women who did not conform, there were a number of very stringent punishments. Their children were bastards, for one thing, which is a very still is a very severe legal disability. And as they couldn't earn any money themselves, I mean, I was just running it down dinner time. I was thinking over all the different ways you impose your will, and you know, that any individual, say you're dealing with someone, you want them to do X. You know, you induce them to do X, and you force them to do X. And if they don't do X, you punish them. So there's a sort of three-pronged attack in the law falls in with that, or maybe the culture just fell in with the law. in modern jurisprudence, it's manifested by, say, a rape situation is a very good example of the problem. If you are raped and you decide to complain about it, well, it's an important, number one, important decision, because only by and large, only chaste, whatever that is, women, and reputedly chaste women, and that's everybody's, everybody thinks that. I don't know where you can dig up a person who's a victim and that is so clearly can't be attacked that way. What happens is the defense is by and large to attack the woman's character. So, for instance, it's very hard for prostitutes to be raped or married women or anyone over about 2 years of age, as far as I can see. So there's a whole unpleasant resume and of past history and a number of idle speculations and so on, which are intended to discredit. And it would be utterly irrelevant. I mean, when one man bashes another man over the head with a bottle in a pub or something, this never comes up. Your head ever been bashed before, you know? So, you think, what's the point of these questions, you know? And then you realize, well, there's this two-class system, and we're only protecting people in this one class, you know, which, in my view, admittedly somewhat cynical, and probably wrong for that reason, view, it's related to the question of inheritance and the uncertainty of patrimony. So, in other words, if you look like you were originally a candidate for the privileges of being supported in a situation in which you cannot, for instance, earn an adequate living by and large without some sort of extraordinary good fortune or enormous effort, then it's the law will protect you, because those were the class of women that were going to be producing the certifiably mine offspring. You know? On the other hand, if you fall outside that class, you have quite a hard time earning a living, and there are all kinds of reprisals. I was in court the other day doing a soliciting case, and I spent some time listening to this very obscene morality squad officer going through this thing. It's really ugly. I mean, it's incredible to me. Just an incredibly ugly man, and he obviously got such a big thrill out of the fact that there were women propositioning him on the street, you know, which I thought any rational judge would consider to be manifestly false, you know, just on. But anyway, you know, prostitution is not illegal any longer. What's supposed to be illegal is making sales on the street, you know. And so there's a whole ugly scene goes on for the woman concerned, not for the man. And that's a fairly blatant modern example of the type of discrimination, type of punishment that happens to women who are not in the legally protected class. And all the way through, the law is kind of strikingly oriented to basically what comes down to the question of inheritance and the question of property in our system. When you go to court doing a soliciting charge, what you're dealing with is the protection of property. This person is outside the area of people we need to protect and can be harassed and so on. It's always interesting because on the one hand, there's the two pools of women, for producers and then there's the ones which are just for the sort of cheaper variety. Cheaper literally economically. It is much cheaper to go down on Granville Street and spend $35 than it is to undertake the lifetime expenses of an individual. So there's a sort of conflict in the culture that I think at least is very much reflected by the law, but it's at least interesting as well. know, to look at. Particularly as I think, and it's just an aside, it's nothing to do with law, but I think that's one of the ways in which women are spectacularly conned right at the moment, and particularly in the sort of more radical community, that they are, it's like this new bill that's come up, the new consumer bill, the equalization of property or something, I forget what it's called exactly, but and the effect of it is that you can equally be sued for your husband's debt. A number of other very equal things, you know, it's just a bunch of bullshit because they don't earn any money comparably to their husbands, you know. But anyway, so, all right, this is just a hot cold stare move away from this bloody thing. I'm saying dead silence. All right, this booklet. I don't have the booklet for you tonight, and we'll have them next week. This begins with a resume of what the implications of marrying someone are, and what the implications, followed by what the implications of not marrying someone are. So it's of some interest. Fundamentally, the relationship is that there is an exchange between, and this is legally, I want to make it clear that I'm not speaking about individual variations, or I'm not speaking about the very real and powerful emotional and spiritual commitments between individual couples, whatever that couple may be made up of, you know. I'm just talking about the kind of crass way. The law is a very crass kind of instrument in this area, and I'm just talking about that crassness as it illustrates that it's been tolerated that way, illustrates something of its self-interest, about the culture. That's the mildest statement of it.
I don't know, maybe it's the mildest statement too.
Anyway, from a legal point of view, if you marry someone, if the you is a woman, then you are obligated for certain sexual services. Fundamentally, I did an analysis about 2 years ago to discover precisely what it was that the law required of you, and it appears that, except in the case of extremely old women, that the definition of a woman for legal purposes is a being with a functional vagina. There's two cases that finally sort of dramatically pinpoint this, and one involves a woman who had been through a sex change, and the question in a divorce action was whether this individual was a woman. It was a very, very savage case, British case. Extremely cruel outcome in terms of the effect on the individual, because it was decided that the person was clearly not a man, and because of the artificial nature of the vagina, because it didn't operate in exactly the same way as whose, I'd like to know, but anyway, there was 120 days of expert testimony from a whole bevy of male specialists. Well, I shouldn't say anyway. That this person was not either a woman, so therefore there couldn't be a divorce because there was therefore never a valid marriage. That's another interesting point that isn't kept to people's mind, that a valid marriage appears to be one between people of opposite sexes, which is another whole area of the law which is disconcerting, to say the least. Anyway, the companion case from an analytic point of view was one in Ontario where a man sought to divorce his wife on the grounds of non-consummation. It was more interesting than that. Not on non-consummation, but on refusal over a long period of time to have sexual intercourse. I don't think they ever established whether there had ever been. Her argument was
spiritual reasons, and that there was a spiritual relationship between the two of them, and that was the crucial thing. There was, in other words, no fault on her part, and she had that was a valid reason for marrying and a valid exchange within the marriage. And of course, as you can imagine, it was held again, no spirit sex, period. So those two things taken together, and that there are no contrary ones that I am aware of, other than in the case of women of extreme age who have not held out that they have a functioning vagina, that seems that that's the crucial thing. I found that very offensive and irritating, and actually when you read other parts of the law in a way that's more or less, it seems to me, what would make the most sense as an analysis when you see in all the kinds of protective legislation that goes along with it, and it's all kind of oriented towards this function. Divorce is a good example that that's such a serious fault still. You know, if you want a quick divorce, you've either got to prove that one or other of you was a physical or mental brute, or failing that, a fairly quick, well, very quick answer to the whole question is to prove that somebody slept with somebody else without your permission. So that seems a crucial thing. Conversely, men are supposed at least to be able to function initially, sexually also. And I think that has to do at least with state interests as to the population. You know that the rules around abortion and contraception were developed in the mid-19th century in response to a population crisis in Europe. And there was pressure from the church in France, where the first of this sort of legislation was passed, and from very large segments of the government to have bodies. And so what had been a common practice until then amongst the great chunks of the population, i.e. birth control of one, who knows, crude, sophisticated, most of that has been lost in form or another, and the practice of abortion, which is quite common, were made criminal offenses. Just as an aside again, I think that the criminal sanction against contraceptives was removed from our enlightened criminal code about 3 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. I think it's 3. I'll come across this. This thing was very, very recently, long past the time of the more or less acute awareness of the population crisis. So, I mean, that is in itself sort of interesting statistic, because although since the time of the mid-19th century, there's been a number of religious rationales developed for that, to support in support of those sets of rules. They came out of a much more debasing concept of women than simply their womb being the property of the country, and, you know, switch the factories into high gear, or now they don't need them so much, so turn them off for 50 years. Now I'm sure in 100 years if the population crisis in the other direction, it will become again illegal to contracept or abort or whatever. Once a woman is married to a man, she acquires a number of very valuable rights. She has the right, mostly financial, the right to being maintained at the standard of living that he chooses. I mean, that's the book in that pile. I mean, it's his choice, and where he chooses. If, for example, I were to get married again and have, you know, worked out a way of life here as I have, and my husband decided that he wanted to live in some fascist country, say, like the United States, and I wouldn't go there, then I would have deserted him. You know, even if he didn't have a job. legally speaking, of course, there's a hell of a lot of maneuvering in between. And that's the cleverness of women, of course, is the amount of maneuvering they've learned to do over the centuries, and it's not to really be put down. You know, it's all the sort of caginess and everything of working out the bargains and all these sort of things, and other methods of getting one's own way and so on, have been developed of necessity. You know, and though they're offensive in a certain way, I mean, it's hard to tell. Today I had a nervous breakdown. I came down the stairs. It was a boat to go somewhere. Get where I was from, but anyway. And there was a woman in the lobby with the very shortest imaginable skirt and very flared, like a cheerleading costume skirt. Not the pleated kind, but the kind that when people turn around in a circle, it makes like a sort of real short circle skirt. So the edges of the circle that are standing up when the person is standing still, you can see their bums, right? So I'm standing there thinking, for fuck's sake, get something on, you know? Why do you do this to me? You know, because it's embarrassing, you know. I said to this man that I was with, well, how would you feel if we came down, and, oh yeah, that's not the worst of it. The other part was that it's very, very a bosomy individual and had on a sort of dress that came down to here and had a habit of walking like this. I mean, I was just standing there, I was so outraged. I thought, you dare insult me, I can work my ass over. I come down here and I'm right back into this. So it's going through this whole harangue, you see, I'm going through the whole thing. I'm thinking, you know, why the fuck is this happening and why can everybody put their damn clothes on? And then when I was coming back to sitting on some stairs, so I mean, it was a whole situation. I never know who to blame, see, because then if I let her off the hook by saying, hell, what choices are there? You know, the culture sets her up for this. Then I've got to let all the men off the hook, right? I mean, it's a very tricky business. Because then, today also, I went through a lot of trauma. I had a very heavy day. I just about completely OD today. So I was in this restaurant where people also wear short skirts. But they at least wear the rest of their clothes pretty adequately. But it's a very kind of bad place in one way or another. So then I started thinking about that place called the Penthouse, which is rumored to be, and I say rumored only because I've been studying libel long. Anyways, that this place for 35 or so years has been a chief cat house or whatever in Vancouver, and I was frothing in the mouth about that and raging particularly. I was working illegally for a month recently, and a woman came in and she got busted for soliciting in this place, you know, which every policeman and every other official of every kind that hasn't had his head in the wax, you know, knows very well what goes on, and that every single time they own the taxi that takes the woman to the hotel. So all I know, they own the hotel as well. You know, the deal is that people sit around, the men come and sit at the tables, and they make these deals, and then off they go in the taxi. Then they come back and pay off to get a certain percentage. I know the details of this because I'm spending my, you know, I had a long battle with her association. It was, you know, she finally decided it went off. But anyhow, so I knew the whole system. I also knew that all the men knew it. I mean, all the ones which, you know, it's like a conspiracy in a certain way, a silence about it or support or whatever. So I was raging about that early in the day. And so, on the other hand, then, if I'm going to be cheesed off with them and hold them right responsible for what they may do in a sort of instinctive way, I have to force the same onus on the women. I mean, that's the whole problem, I guess, in the whole women's movement. Either we're responsible for what we do and they're responsible, therefore they're shit, or otherwise, we're not responsible, neither are they, and they're not shit, and no one can blame them. You know, I would feel it's easier if you can hold someone right to the... Well, when she was talking about this woman dressing like that and so on. Anyway. All right. Now, with the, when people marry one another, the woman in this province, at least, does not acquire an automatic half interest in anything whatsoever. Except now, according to law, she acquires, if she can afford it, a full interest in all his debts. That is a big step forward, as you can see. But anyhow, so I should mention that the law, just for, maybe everybody knows this, shout at me if you know all the stuff that I'm saying, because I don't want to be patronizing in any kind of way. I just want to make sure I cover it. The Constitution leaves civil law matters up to each province. So the civil law varies quite considerably in some areas from province to province. So in this province, at least, you don't have a half interest. Supposing that you're buying a house, and it's registered in his name while it's his house. That's always a pretty good way of telling whose house it is, whose name it's in. And it's a point to remember. There is there is an act in which, I forget, I've got it over here, where you can, a wife can go put a lien on a house as long as they've lived there sometime, one house, so that it doesn't mean that she gets to own half of it or anything like that, but it does mean that if he tries to sell it out from under her to somebody who knows, she's got a lien on, and if it's registered, then they'll know, they'll seem to know, then that's not a good sale. You can't kick her out without going to court and talking about it. You know. But if she should happen, supposing he's gone for 10 years or something, and sometime during that time she happens to go to bed with someone else, which is, you know, at least barely possible. But anyways, that's it. Unless you can prove that you contributed to the house when it was intended that you were going to get half of it. But the safest bet is, and this is the hardest thing to do, you see, I mean, is to get stuff at the beginning. That's the trick. You see, I think that's the hard part. That's one thing that women have to really work on themselves for, because I don't know if it's a cliche of my own mind or not. But I think that my own experience with women and with being a woman is that in a sort of emotional clutch situation, i.e. Sort of early mixed feelings about everything, it's not usual that it's the woman who says, do I stand to see my friend, or what are you talking about? You think I'm out of my mind? I want it on the line. I mean, I've only had one case where some guy went to sell his property, came in and said, the bitch, 20 years ago, she registered a lien on it. We'd only been married about 2 weeks. I said, good for her, you know. But that's the only case I've heard of, and there's like hundreds where the wife has, you know, 50 kids and he buggers off, and it's a big struggle to get any interest in the house recognized. Although you can go to court and say, well, because I've got all these children, or I'm old and thin out and otherwise useless, you've got to give me some share of it, you know. I mean, it's a very hard position. It's like, it's so much easier to get something if it's yours than to get it by, you know, going and being pathetic, you know. Right? And it's hard. I mean, it's a hard thing to pull off. It's saying they try to be pathetic, and the judge is so very irritating. Shut up. They say, wait a minute. Out. So, okay. There's certain kinds of rules about husbands and wives testifying against one another. In civil matters, i.e. non-criminal matters, they must. That's providing anyone can prove that they know anything about each other. That's the first point. If anyone ever don't know, don't make any statements. For all legal matters, never say anything. That's the first point and the last point and all the intermediate points. If people want you to take tests and do different things, all this is giving evidence against yourself. Oh, well, I'm on a clinic. I better push. When, don't trust, don't go to social workers ever or, and tell everyone you know, don't do this. And tell them what's truly happening. You feel like battling your kids, talk to yourself about it. Talk to another, you know, these different groups that are forming. But not the ones that some groups now are being sneakily formed by the children. They that look just exactly like self-help groups, and they are. One of the really wretched things. Right, well then I'm sorry if you're going to resent it because it just happens. I mean, if it doesn't apply to you, it doesn't apply. But I just did a study on the Vancouver Children's Aid, and one of the tricks that is done that is scandalous and outrageous, and it used to be done also when I used to teach school as well, and I found this out was done by public health as well, another whole group you shouldn't talk to, is that there is a cross-referencing of material. So if I tell the public health nurse that my kids, say I start with the teacher, I say, okay, my kids are late to school, I'm in a real jam around things right now, I'm very upset, there's been real commotions in the family. That information may very well be passed on to the public health. If it's passed on to the public health records are completely and freely available to the Vancouver Children's Aid. I mean, I got interested in the Vancouver Children's Aid after being told one day, because I have four kids, you see, and I was on my own for a long time with those kids, and I was told that if I didn't watch it, because I was so highly visible politically, I would lose them. Not for any other reason. And that's when I thought, okay, here I come. So the next time that social worker saw me, I was all dressed up with my hair piled up in my head in a real tough suit on, and I was on a panel giving advice to that same group. And she walked in, and I had said, don't push me because you'll be sorry, you know. And I meant it. I mean, but the lengths you have to go to is incredible. When you get a client who has gone, a client, for example, this, who had gone to a social worker for ages, confessing many things, who she was sleeping with, how she felt about it, how she felt about her job, when she felt suicidal, the whole psychiatric trip only on the social worker, and you get faced with the lawyer on the other side who says, your client in January 1968 arrived crying and distraught, said could no longer cope with the child, all the things one says to the next door neighbor 50 times a week when one's raising children, out of her mind, problems with men, three different lovers in this particular year, failures with all of them, yak. I mean, you've got a dossier which is so damaging, there's no other case you ever get where they've got that kind of information, unless you've got an absolute fool for a client, where they've gone on us over years. You know, that's what I mean, it's dangerous. And when they come back to that with the public health nurse made a home visit, mother in kimono, 10 o'clock in the morning, hippie type furniture, all those sorts of things are bloody damaging when you're in front of somebody, say in the family court, who has not really met someone out of his own class for, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60 years at least, and who is looking at that and adds that up and says, this person maybe very well is not a competent person to look after his children. You may remember a case that was very well publicized called Grace Bisson case, was in the Underground paper about 2 years ago. She lost all five of her children. She was repeatedly picked up from dinner and put in a straitjacket at the instigation of her children's aid worker and rushed off to Riverview. And nobody would believe her that she was a competent mother. When we got down to the brass tacks on that case, we pulled her psychiatrist in, and her psychiatrist told Judge Banks, who made the original order taking the children away, who made the order returning them, that he had not testified before in her defense because he and a worker at the Burnaby Mental Health had added it up and there were 14 social workers and psychiatric social workers and psychiatrists and medical doctors that they knew of who were all working together to have those children taken away, and there was no use to say one voice. But I managed to get someone who is the psychiatrist, the children's psychiatrist for the Catholic Children's Aid, which is a different agency to deal with, to come, and he hit the ceiling and said the children are autistic children, and anybody in any environment is going to have trouble with them till they outgrow damage they received at birth. And I mean, that was a dramatic example of what happens when that information is interrelated. It's like you commit some sort of small offense in Calgary, another one in Winnipeg, and one in Richmond, and one in Burnaby, and they're all not very important, but all the police records are interconnected. That's the damaging thing from a legal point of view. I mean, from perhaps a social point of view, it would be a good idea if people felt free. No, that wouldn't be a good idea. They already do feel free, and that's a bad idea. If when they felt free to talk to someone, that person didn't feel obliged to make a report of the matter or keep a record of it. But it is as things are now, this is this is such a serious area of the law. You can, for instance, if I go to a private psychiatrist about which nobody knows, no agency knows who or if or anything else, fine, I can say any damn thing I please, unless he's subpoenaed, and then in which case he's going to have to come and he's going to have to testify and he's going to have to talk. That's something you should know. There's no special patient doctor privilege. But where the psychiatrist has been arranged by the agency, the reports most frequently are sent directly to the agency. The patient says X, Y, and Z. I had a case exactly where I had that problem. And the psychiatrist, even when confronted by the patient with the information that their counsel was saying, they had the report from the lawyer for the agency that visits of this and this and this date had been reported as to content and were to be used in court against her, did continue to deny that he was working with the agency. But that cross-referencing is a very, very, very dangerous thing because it doesn't allow for the normal vicissitude, in my view, normal. Who knows? I mean, I'm likely to know people who are like myself, right? So it's not clear. But the normal vicissitudes of living and raising a family or whatever are not clearly appreciated by people who are still being influenced by what is the ideal state, and it's not adequately taken into account that people will blow up. Grace Poussin on one occasion walked in and said, well, God damn it, if you're not going to leave me fuck alone, then take the bloody kids, and walked out. And that's so typical of her. I so sympathize because that's exactly what I'd say. Not because I meant for them to come and take them, and she didn't mean that. Just as far as saying, get off my back, what are you... And went home, and what happened is that night she was picked up and put in a straight jacket in the middle of dinner and dragged off to Riverview again. There are agencies and agencies, clearly, and there are all different people, social workers that are not working in those sorts of agencies, or who work in those agencies independently of those sneaky techniques, fine. But it's very hard to tell for sure which person, when you're dealing with an agency, which person. And as a practical matter, just from a legal point of view, I would say never confess to anything, to anybody, unless the person is your friend or someone that you really can trust is not going to use it against you. Because you get that in court and it is completely damning. It is completely damning. I can't stress how damning that is. And how frightening it is to me that people will go on and on making those extravagant remarks over a period of time without any warning that it's going to be used against them. You see, in a criminal matter, the police, not so much in Canada, they can go ahead and get evidence out of you, and then if it's relevant, they don't have to, that they can give you a warning, it's not important. It's different from the state. State has civil rights. Much in advance of Canada. But still, they have to theoretically give you that warning that whatever you're going to say is going to be used against you, so shut up. And that never happens in those quasi-therapeutic situations, which are also, for those people who run up against it, fact-finding situations. And fighting that kind of a case is extremely difficult, because you have to find someone who is an extremely competent barrister, you know, and who's willing to work for nothing, or now you can get legal aid for such things, $100 or something. Somebody who's going to work for $100. I mean, in the whole city, I can think of half a dozen who are really going to bust their ass and work 3 or 4 weeks to save their kids for $100, you know, just because of the economics of it and the sort of type of morality of the legal profession and so on. So it's a very, very frightening situation, and one that I try very hard to warn people about, you know. So, I don't. But one of the problems, I mean, of course, you're using the loaded argument, and that is, it has been the loaded argument and has been the rationale and the defense for an incredible invasion of people's privacy. Oh, wait a minute. Basically, poor people's privacy, and basically, poor women's privacy. This scary ghost of the battered child, you know. It's a very low percentage situation, not in any way clearly correlated with either people who say they're interested in doing it, or afraid of doing it, or talk about it, or threaten it, or whatever, nor is it correlated in any clear way with economic poverty, which is the usual group that are given the attention of social services. As a matter of fact, in doing some research on this, I discovered statistics, or was given statistics, which indicated that, as a matter of fact, there's a higher correlation between high income and high goal orientation and battering than there was between lower income. But it is lower income people, by and large, who are involved with social agencies and who make the mistake of confessing to them instead of going to a private psychiatrist. And that's the danger. I've never had, well, for one thing, if, say you have a very high income and someone decides to take the kids, it's very simple. You can afford counsel, you can afford psychiatrists. You know to say, I mean, the actual defense for that, for anyone, say that they have hurt their children. Because my concern, I was working at one time on the revision of the Protection of Children's Act, and my argument was that this should not be in a criminal, this should not be in the law. The law should not impose sanctions on people coming forward, because they would never come forward otherwise. I mean, that was the problem. But so to get around that, I have been trying to publicize the other thing, that if you ever hurt your child or anyone else's child, is to rush them immediately to medical attention and tell them, whoever you give the child to, immediately, that you want psychiatric help, and make that as emphatic a statement as you can. Because, see, this is the thing. I mean, I'm going over one case after another, I've discovered that the pattern is, and this is the kind of ad hoc legal crap that goes on all levels. This is sort of an administrative law problem, but what happens is, the person who walks in, the person is scared to death, guilty as hell, and doesn't know what to do, and their kid doesn't go to the hospital, and someone finds out about that person's going to lose their kid. The person who turns up at the hospital is deeply embarrassed about what they have done, and hopeless and so on, and doesn't say anything, doesn't know what to say. I mean, the person's faced with, it's a criminal offense, right? It's going to be a long time in jail for this. They've just blown up, and the kid's hurt, right? So they're in between, they're going to jail, and the kid's going to hospital, and they're going to jail. When I try to say to them, no, that's not what happened, and you don't don't have to lose the kid, and you can get help. What you do is you go into the hospital as fast as you can get there, yelling at the top of your lungs, "I want a psychiatrist, I'm sick." You'll get the psychiatrist, you'll keep your kid. This is in 99% of the cases. But that seems to me very wrong, because then I'm going to get a client who has done something, has gone to the hospital with the kid or not, depending on what happens, and they're going to be, there's no chance for them. I mean, there's no chance that they can be rehabilitated or that they can work out the problem around their kids and have them. Whereas someone else who knew that simple little thing, you go in and you ask for help, which anybody is saying to themselves anyways at the time that they need. If they remember to say it to whoever they're meeting there, they're okay. And that's the trouble. That's the rich, poor law business. It's knowing the tricks and not knowing the tricks. Going to a psychiatrist and saying, "Well, I can't deal with the kids," or just flipped out, "I'm going to hurt one of them." Going to a psychiatrist and saying that, it's a simple thing. In most cases, you vent it and it's over. I mean, probably the feeling is gone as well. But if you don't know that and you pick up the phone and phone your social worker, the next move is you're in family court. Or maybe not that quickly, but you're under supervision. You see what I mean by the
I'd like to be off the record.
Okay, very good. Okay. Now, I think we're original spouses testifying in civil matters. In most criminal matters, you can't be forced to testify against your spouse. Now, broken engagements is the next thing. There used to be a thing that if somebody was engaged to you and they refused, because the marriage thing is a contract and the engagement is a pre-marriage contract, then you could go ahead and break it. Go ahead and sue them and get damages for their breach of promise, just as you could in any other contract. And in a sense, that's what alimony is. It's another breach of contract. Damages for breach of contract. The next section here that I'm just skipping over a couple that are very easily, they're not relevant to most people. To have a valid marriage, you need basically to be old enough to be mentally competent, not to mistake who you marry, marrying the wrong one of identical twins, or I don't know. I mean, I can't see exactly how you get into these mistakes, but these categories of what constitutes a valid marriage came up as a result of defenses that were developed before divorces were easily obtained. And so if you want a divorce, you try anything. It's like trying to get a papal divorce or whatever it is. You use the most ridiculous arguments just to get it. In some states, such as New York, there became a whole elaborate thing around impotency, you know, incapacity to perform sexually for certain periods of time became grounds. You know, it was non-consummation was very broadly construed. If you can prove that whoever you were married was out of their mind at the time, and so therefore they couldn't really consent, all this stuff came up basically because there weren't enough ways out of it, and now there are more ways out of it. If you got married, say you were underage and you fudged something about the certificate to get the license, to get it all organized, and then afterwards you decide, okay, this person's a swine and I don't wish to be married to them, once the judge finds out that you slept with one another, really before or after, it's okay, it was a good marriage. I mean, that's the whole hysterical thing of it. If you're say you're living here in BC, there's this thing of domicile, which is your place where you really need to live for the rest of your life, you know. Yeah, so say you're domiciled in BC and your husband, you get married and your husband lives in Alberta, wants to live in Alberta, that arbitrarily becomes your domicile, as I was mentioning earlier. And so that the influence of that is that then you become subject to all the rules and regulations. about changing your name. There's no act that says you have to use your husband's name. There is an act that says if you want to change your name, you have to do it with your husband's permission. My own contention is that you never are stuck with his name anyway, no matter when you used it. Penny Bain, who prepared much of the material that will be in the booklet that you eventually get if you want it, thinks that the deal is that if you get married and you never use any name but whatever name you are then using, your single name or whatever, you never take his name, then you never have to use it, but if you use it at any time, you're stuck with it forever. But as there's no place that says that's the effect of marriage, that you lose your name, I think technically you don't have to use his name no matter what. You can always use your own name. In any event, that's an important consideration, say, for women who are currently married to someone and have been Mrs., you know, somebody or other for X number of years and suddenly decide this is ridiculous, I'm going to use my own name. The problem is to discover what your own name is. You've got your father's name and you've got your husband's name. My name is Davidson right now, which happens to be my father's name. But before that, it was quite a while before that, it was Moore. And in between, it was Davidson Moore. Because I said, oh, well, I'll make one up and see that's in between. Because I don't have any identification with anyone except maybe Malcolm X. You know? And I thought, well, they've done that trick with the alphabet. You know, I don't know what. I don't know what to use for our last name. So once you decide to use your own name, you just be embarked on the whole problem. I mean, it's very hard to figure out which one. What is the time? Does anybody have a clock or a watch? 10 to 9. Do you want to have a break or do you want to just finish up or what? No, I don't, but I would like it if people ask them more questions. Maybe we could just have questions. But, oh, good. Well, it's a very serious problem. The customs department do the same. I mean, I'm not sure that you're saying that they force you then to use your husband's name there, but I know that the customs departments are so vulgar as to do just that. They have no legal rights to do it. None. Given her position, it does not. But there's another factor that you should be aware of, that in this country you can use any name you please. This is different from the states. The states you may not. But here, or I understand you may not, I don't know that for sure, but here you can. It's not an offense. What it's an offense to do is to assume someone else's identity. Supposing that I say my name is Mary Alice. That's fine, nobody gives a shit about that. But if everyone knows who this Mary Alice is, like I'm the Mary Alice who lives at 612, Starling Crescent or something, and who, works in the Safeway in Richmond or something, and there is that person, then that's a criminal offense and I'm in serious trouble. But I'm otherwise not in serious trouble. I mean, I'm very sure that you can just, as one who's been through all these different names lately, and I mean, I've just begun. you know, it seems to be perfectly fine, but when you're dealing with the BC telephone, they're such arbitrary people that, I mean, you've got such little leverage in dealing with a company like that, particularly a monopoly. It's sort of, you want to work here, you know. It's sort of like talking about strictly women's rights and talking to a woman who is living in a household where the man is in control of the house. You know, I'm not saying every house is like that, but there are some that are like that, and says, no, in this environment you don't have any rights. Then you don't. You know, it's a technical argument. You could be the test case, say, and in the future they couldn't do it to anyone. But you would be working elsewhere, presumably, by then. That's the trouble. I mean, that's always the trouble about being a test case. You get screwed, but everyone else gets the benefit. So you really have to be a kind of missionary about it. But, you know, if you're thinking of quitting BC Cal anyway, you know, it's worth doing. Maybe not worth quitting, but, you know, worth making yourself that tip. Are there other questions? Yes? Yeah, oh yeah, that's fine. Yeah, that's a good question. Just now, I thought I could just go off the top of my head, but I don't know you did. Indecent assault, just off the top of my head, is there has been no intercourse. Just a minute, I'll just get the section. This thing is the criminal code. It's a very handy thing with it, and it has at the back a number of other relevant acts that do with it. To do with it. Rape, to begin with, which I don't particularly think I need to look up, although I may do to get it exactly right, is intercourse without permission. You have both of them, indecent assault as well. Yeah, that seems to be part of the problem. All right, just a second. Can I answer this after the break? Would that be okay? Because I could do it off the top of my head, but I've developed this habit of, I think I'm getting totally indoctrinated, is to always look up the section and so on to make sure I'm not, I think that's just too great of carefulness or something. But anyways, if you didn't mind, I would do it anyways, because I'm getting compulsive about it. Any other, yes? To get one. Well, one thing I would do is just get a whole other passport and just use my birth certificate. You know, your birth certificate's going to have, in case that's the name you want to use. Otherwise, otherwise, I mean, I'd be happy to do a test case if anybody wants to do one. I mean, I think it's so fundamental that you can't bloody well be your own name. I would like to do another test case I was just talking about tonight that's the same kind of thing related to these very fundamental incapacities of women in front of the law. And that is on the question of legitimacy. It's something that is perhaps not as starkly realized by everyone, but it is impossible for a woman to legitimize her own child. It is not impossible for a man. And I think that's terrible because it means that a woman cannot have a first-class citizen, a child, without the intercession of a man. So one is always a petitioner in that regard. And that one incident, that one fact, I think is the most scandalous indication of the status of women. For example, there is a procedure which is not commonly known, whereby a man can go down and sign a deed in which he legitimates his child for the purposes of inheritance again and other purposes. So in this province, the child of any woman is presumed to be the legitimate child of that woman for inheritance purposes. It is not the legitimate child for any other purpose whatsoever and cannot be made the legitimate child. So, pardon me? There are any number of other purposes. If you're injured, say you're working, you have a whole set of problems, partly remedied by the Family Relations Act, but there's a whole set of problems, say with the Canada Pension Plan thing. Those sorts of things, your child's illegitimate, then too bad. Say that your kid's legitimate for your purposes of your will. Say the child's grandparents die. Unless the parent grandparents say in their will, to my grandchild, whom I know to be illegitimate, or to my illegitimate grandchild, or my will covers all my illegitimate grandchildren. I mean, lately I've taken to writing wills that way, you know, for people, just to cover everything that might come up, you know. But where they're specifically worried about that individual child, you know, they cannot, because a child does not exist unless it's legitimate in many legal classifications. But for example, the thing that's the most hideous act, I'm very vitally interested in this question. I have read every goddamn thing I could find. You know? So it just rankles me that's the fact. I mean, you're just so impotent in that situation. You know, is this children of unwed parents, for which parents are really mothers, you know? Anyways, that act is just the most hideous act.
I believe Section 6 of it. There's a superintendent of welfare, now called superintendent of something else, anyway, the old-fashioned child welfare superintendent. He gets to move in. Normally, if he's moving in, it's via the Protection of Children's Act. And although that act is so broad, I mean, any child can be picked up from any home in theory under that act, Section 7 of that act. Under the Children of Unwed Parents Act, the whole thing is, the presumption underlying the whole act is that without a man on the scene, the state must supply one as a guardian, both of the mother and the child. It's just dreadful, and it is not clear. Right now I have a case where two women, one had a child and wished to pass the guardianship to the other for very sufficiently good reasons, including the fact that the other had looked after that child. But the one who's the natural mother was also an unmarried mother. So it's not clear. We have a guardianship paper